Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home. It's time to find out what's trending.
What's trending in King County?
So Secretary of State Kim Wyman worked with Governor Jay Inslee to secure funding for paid postage on the mail-in ballots for this year's primary and general election. They think it's going to increase voter turnout. It's not, and we'll get to that in a second. But there's a caveat in the general funding that I think is so awesome. It's awesome because it's pissing off Seattle Democrats. This funding is not paying for the ballots in King County. Oh, that's awesome. Instead, they're asking the state legislature next year to reimburse King County. And I'm told that County Council Chair Joe McDermott is not happy. Two explanation points. That's how unhappy he is. He's not angry. He's not disappointed. He's not happy. I think he's going to be on the show tomorrow to explain. He's calling it grossly unfair. He says it's unfair that he's not getting the payment and all these other places are. But the reason they're not getting the payment is because they passed it when the state was like, whoa, 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 before you decide to unilaterally in King County offer paid postage. No, we're trying to get this done on a statewide level. And if you go ahead and jump the gun, you're putting everybody else at a disadvantage. And Kim Wyman, who's a supporter of paid postage, she made the point to our sister station, Kyle Radio, saying they kind of brought this on themselves.
The county passing it on their own is what put all of this in motion. If the council had not done it at all, obviously we wouldn't be having this discussion. They waited so late in the election planning cycle and did it in such a quick manner that we had a very short window of time to respond. My concern was that a voter who couldn't afford a stamp in Yakima County, for example, could be being treated differently than a voter in King County just by geography.
Now, I don't buy the I can't afford a stamp argument, but I mean, she's absolutely right. King County brought this on themselves. They wanted to be the first, and as a result of them being the first, they ended up losing $385,000, at least in the short term. It's not like they're not going to make it up. So I don't know why they're complaining about this. Are things really tight in King County government? They're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on all these things. They don't have $383,000. I guess they had it before the state decided that they were going to reimburse. And by the way, as much as I love this, and I'm a supporter of this, and I'm willing to pay the taxes, which is weird because the tax I'd probably end up having to pay to accommodate paid postage is probably about the price of a stamp. It's annoying and inconvenient to get a stamp because we don't mail things anymore. I've made this joke multiple times, but it's not really a joke. I'm not lying. I still have a package of Forever stamps I bought at Costco 6.5 years ago, and I found it over the weekend. It's yellow. It's like it's changing colors.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how infrequently I mail things. I only mail it during my ballots. And so I still have it. And that's what I've been using. I'm okay with this because the other thing is when I can't find those stamps, I just go to the front desk and I steal from my company and get them to give me a stamp.
Oh, wow. So this is technically, I mean, kind of a pro-business decision.
It's very much pro-business. It's pro-business, it's pro-rants. So I'm okay with it. But let's be clear, it's not changing voter turnout. The reason why people don't vote is they're both a combination of lazy and disinterested. That's generally why people don't vote. Laziness and disinterest. And if you're disinterested in it and you don't know what it is you're talking about or what it is you're voting on, I'm okay keeping the voter level low. I'd rather you actually do some research before you voted. And if you're not willing to do that, I don't need to make it easier for you to vote. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
Seattle has passed their head tax, and my next guest says it's going to impact his business, which is outside of Seattle. State Senator Mark Mullett, he's a Democrat from Issaquah. He's also a businessman, and he says his business, Zeke's Pizza in Issaquah, will be negatively impacted by the head tax. He joins me now. Good morning. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, good morning, Jason.
So I've been saying this for a while, that whatever happens in Seattle doesn't just stay in Seattle. It impacts a whole bunch of businesses outside of the region. So for you, how does it impact your business in Issaquah?
Well, I think what I've seen, you know, I've been in Jerry's ice cream stores and pizza restaurants in Issaquah, well, on the east side. None of them are in the city limits that I own. And but all my customers, this is where they work at. Like, they all work for the large regional employers in the Puget Sound, whether that's Starbucks or, you know, Amazon, it doesn't matter. And so my growth in my business over the last 6 years, a lot of that's been because these companies have been hiring people. And as people move here and they have good paying jobs, they buy pizza and ice cream. Mm-hmm. And once those jobs go away, my customers go away. That's the real challenge, I think, of what Seattle's doing. Makes it difficult for small business owners. The idea that it's only impacting 3% of businesses is sheer insanity. Because for one, those 3% of businesses employ half the people in Seattle. And two, that trickles down to every business outside the city where all those people actually live, not just where they work. So.
So are your colleagues, other folks who own their own small businesses, are they also scared of the reality now as a result of this head tax?
Yeah, I think everybody's nervous that, you know, nervous about what it's going to do in terms of economic growth in our region as we're sending a message to the rest of the country that we're going to penalize you for creating jobs here.
So your colleague, Mark Schessler, he wants to clarify language in a current existing law to make sure that this Seattle head tax can't actually go through. If it's passed, it would work retroactively, so it would essentially kill this head tax. Do you support that legislation?
Yes, I've been saying that if they decided to move forward, which obviously they did yesterday, that this has statewide implications. That I chair the Financial Institutions Committee in the Senate, and we're constantly meeting with other companies from other states and other countries trying to get them to invest here to create jobs, and the largest city in your state is undermining that message. I think it prompts the reason why we have a state legislature and why we might need a policy bill. My suggestion is I'm willing to enhance the amount of money the state invests in affordable housing, specifically in King County, so we can solve the problem that they're trying to solve. But my trade-off would be if we're going to increase those investments to create more affordable housing in King County, then they have to, we would also combine that with a law that prevents you from penalizing someone for creating a job, such as the head tax law they just voted on.
So do you anticipate a lot of Democrats breaking with Seattle on this? Because, you know, we generally don't hear this kind of language coming from Democrats. There's this general sense that, you know, yes, there's some differences in ideological positions, but they're still progressive.
I think it's going to be a lift. Our session starts, first off, we're not in session until January 14th. So Our next session is January 14th, April 28th. So we're a ways down the road. It's 7 months until we're back in Olympia to create laws again. And you are correct. I think it's going to, you know, we have our work cut out for us to try to get other Democrats on board to go against the Seattle City Council. At some point, I believe they're bad for the Democratic brand. I think the brand of Democrats is we want to create jobs in the state. And if you have a elected municipal body sending the opposite message, you have to break ranks with them.
Yeah. Are they out of control?
I'm very frustrated. And I, because I don't live in Seattle and I can't vote for them, it's hard for... But the policies they're voting on are having huge impacts on my ability to be a successful small business owner in Issaquah, and it's frustrating.
When you look at your own colleagues in the Democratic Party statewide, how different are they than the progressives and the socialists in the Seattle City Council?
It's very different. I always joke that it only takes me 20 minutes to drive down to meetings in Seattle, but I feel like a Republican from Alabama when I get there, because even though we're all Democrats, I'm like, man, how can we all be Democrats? Like, They are so far left of me, and I don't can. I mean, I'm pretty liberal on all the social issues. I think my challenge as a business owner is I realize that the businesses aren't just rolling in all this money, and this idea that they're not going to choose to locate elsewhere if you're going to penalize them is insanity, because they will locate somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's my fear, is what's going to happen.
Well, this tax impacts lots of folks outside of Seattle. It impacts people regardless of whether or not they have an R or a D next to their name. And I do hope that once the session is back in session, once the legislative session starts up in January, you're able to get some Democrats to come to your side on this particular issue, join Republicans in a nice bit of bipartisanship, and end what is just a disaster of attacks against Amazon and a lot of other big businesses, but also it impacts a lot of small businesses outside of Seattle. So I wish you the best of luck. Again, I've been talking with State Senator Mark Mullett. He's a Democrat from Issaquah. We appreciate you coming on this morning and giving us your take.
Thanks a lot, Jason.
Absolutely.
Have a really good morning. Take care.
You're listening to The Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to The Jason Rancho live in the Online Trading Academy studio. If you want to join the conversation, send me a text message at 1-800-465-8770. It's the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. Jacob knows this because almost every single day after I just shout into the ether how much I hate my life, I'll complain about my iPhone. I have the iPhone X. It's a dumpster fire of a phone. And they refuse to replace it. They've asked me to go in, but they don't have any appointments available when I'm free. So it's just been a nightmare. I will never, ever, 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 ever go back to Apple again. And I've been thinking about going with either a Google Pixel or what's the Android everyone keeps? Galaxy Note?
Samsung
Note 9 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
People keep saying it's an amazing phone. So I've been thinking, okay, I'm going to go to that. But now I'm rethinking that because apparently Google is out with news that they want to help you be cured of your phone addiction. And one, it feels kind of condescending because you're selling me a phone, but you don't want me to use it. Like, I don't, just stop. Just you give me the phone that I'm going to become addicted to. Let's have people who are experts in treating addiction be the ones who are offering their services. So it's just weirdly condescending. And the truth is, it's just going to be annoying because they say, this is what the vice president of product management of Google says. His name is Samir Samat. 70% of people want more help striking this balance with how much you use your phone and how you engage in your normal life. Wanting something doesn't mean you're going to get it if you're dealing with an addiction. And unless you go through actual legitimate treatment, there's nothing Samsung or Google is going to be able to offer us that will break our addiction. All you're doing is making it more annoying and more of a nuisance to use. Here are the features.
Yeah.
Just tell me if any of this would change the way, if you're truly addicted to your phone, how you use it. A dashboard app that tells you how often you use your phone.
Yes.
Would it?
Yes.
Why? If you're addicted, do you not know how many cigarettes you smoke every single day and you continue to buy new packs of cigarettes?
I know that if I'm interested in losing weight, I just start tracking how many
calories
I'm eating.
Unless you're addicted to food. And then you just start eating again. Like, knowing the information.
But
we all know it.
But that's the point, though. No one's really addicted to their phones. It's just very easy and convenient.
Is it, though? I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's true. I think that there's a legitimate... I can't remember the author I talked to about 2 years ago. He's from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
He was in town doing a town hall event. He said, no, this is an actual addiction much similar to what you experience if you're addicted to heroin. Mm. Like that, it changes...
But it is.
It's just not... It's a different type of part of the brain
that it's appealing to. But true addiction...
That's what he says.
The definition of it involves like serious harm to your well-being and your
there
life outside of the phone.
Harm.
There
could be. I mean, because
are children being neglected because of people's use of phones?
Extreme cases, but that's not the norm. Addiction doesn't necessarily mean something bad comes of it. It's the potential of something bad that comes of it, right? Because someone could be addicted to cigarettes and not actually get lung cancer, right? You can smoke cigarettes all the time and still be relatively healthy. It's rare.
Mm-hmm.
The addiction is simply what your body's response to this stimulus is.
But generally,
it's not necessarily negative. But yes, it's generally, we view it as a negative.
We often don't, but we're not telling people that they need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous until they've done something that seriously harms themselves or someone else.
Or the potential.
Otherwise, they're just like someone who, but that's the point. That's exactly the point, is that the potential.
Yeah, but that's also talk therapy, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is not therapy. This is just telling you that this is on your app. This is how long you've been using your phone.
I'm saying it'd be helpful. I think there's a lot of people where it's like, If there was some way that they better monitored, how much alcohol I'm drinking, they'd do it less.
They say set time limits on how long you can use an app. So you can say, I only want to use Twitter or whatever the app is for 30 minutes today, or maybe only 5 minutes at a time. And then it'll either lock you out or you'll just get a warning that says, hey, you big jerk, you just said you only wanted to use it for 10 minutes, but you're on it for 32 minutes now. It's time to move on. I tried to limit my use of Twitter, and I was good for about 2 weeks, but then the addiction kicked in. And the funny thing is, so what I ended up doing, I moved my Twitter to a different folder and I put it on the second page. Mm-hmm. I still haven't moved it back. I'm tweeting more than I've ever tweeted. Like I just now go to that spot, and I stopped myself from retweeting and writing. I was still reading it for work, but for the most part, I stopped interacting. It was good 2 weeks, right?
About
2 weeks I wasn't doing much.
Sure.
And I was happier.
Okay.
But because I'm an addict, I went back. There's only so much you can do. Now, I knew, and me putting it in this other folder is my way of telling myself.
Delete it off your phone, then. Delete it off your
phone. I don't want to. I'll tell you what happens. I'll reinstall it in a day.
So basically, you're like a binge Twitter user because you think you can have it on your phone, but you can't stop your phone.
It's someone who loses 10 pounds over the course of a month and then gains 42 pounds mm-hmm. the next day.
Can't keep
after
it off.
They decide that, oh, I just tasted sugar again, or hot dogs and burgers and chips and whatever. That's what that was my Twitter use. My clout score has gone up through the roof though since I got back. I've got the highest clout score in all of Bonneville, Seattle. Did you know that?
I didn't.
Did you know that?
And it wasn't
cool?
Interested.
Isn't that cool?
Isn't that cool? Not interested.
Higher than Brock Huard.
Okay.
Higher than Dave Ross.
Is it?
Yeah. I'm Brock higher than Huard. Michael Medved. Yeah, my clout score is higher than everybody. I credit Ben Shapiro for retweeting all my stuff. That's what helps. It's the Jason Rantz Show. If you want to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/JasonRantz. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show on AM 770, KTTH, and 94.5 FM in the Greater East Side. A student is suing Washington State University, calling them out for negligence in their failure to protect her from a hostile campus environment that led to some significant racist taunts. Dominique Stewart was 18 years old when this allegedly happened back in 2015. She's represented by a local lawyer, a friend of mine, Ann Bremner. And Dominique joins me this morning. Dominique, thank you so much for coming on.
Having me.
So let's talk about what ended up happening. It seems to have all started in February of 2015. You were a freshman at the time. You went to a fraternity party where you say you were targeted because you're black. So tell us what happened.
Yes. So at the time of the incident, my friends and I had been invited to Phi Delta Theta. One of my friends was having a birthday party. And, you know, the night seemed to go very well. Until we were leaving the fraternity. And as we were leaving the fraternity, one of the members had decided to yell derogatory names at me and proceeded to slam the door in my face. You know, that night was just, you know, one of the worst nights of my life. There was fraternity members on the balcony who were recording and laughing at us, and you know, it was just overall such a negative experience.
What were you called?
So I was called the N-word and the B-word.
And was there any indication as to why they were targeting you? Did it seem like it was random?
Yeah, so I had no idea who that person was at all. I was actually just waiting on the porch for my friend. They had gone back into the house to use the bathroom really quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the members had come from a side exit and just yelled, like, you know, get the F out of my face, you N-word, B-word, wow. And then slammed the door in my face. And, you know, another member opened the door and said, oh, sorry, he didn't mean that. He was intoxicated, and then slammed the door in my face again.
Huh. Okay.
So I was just...
So the drunk defense.
Waiting on the... Yeah. Yeah. I was just waiting on the porch for my friends, really.
So...
Not harming anyone else.
You end up reporting it to officials at Wazoo, and it sounds like at least initially they handled this correctly in that they ended up expelling that kid, so not just from the fraternity but from the school in general. Were you happy with that decision?
You know, I felt like at that point, I don't know if expelling was the right choice. I just wanted the person to learn that it's not okay for him to use those words to anyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe some diversity training. I'm not really sure if, you know, Phi Delta even really learned from that situation. And I felt that it wasn't just him who was involved with the situation. It was the other members who were laughing on the porch and, you know, who were kind of sticking up for him in the sense of saying, oh, he doesn't mean that, he was just intoxicated. It wasn't just a single isolated situation.
So where is this lawsuit coming from? If they end up expelling you, obviously you'd like to see some training, but they're not, I don't think, required to go through that training, and they did punish the one student. So you're claiming negligence. Why are you unhappy?
I would say that I'm unhappy because I felt like there was multiple situations going on. When I went back to the university, I had chicken thrown at my head. I had people on social media saying threats and harassment, and I overall was isolated in my room. I just felt like the university didn't provide the adequate safety procedures that I needed at that time.
What were you asking for at the time? And so obviously you were talking with the school. I know you met with one of the members, the Wazoo Interim Vice President for Student Affairs.
Yeah.
So what did you ask for? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so on March 1st, my mom and I had met with Melinda Husky to address my family's concerns, which included the hostile campus climate and safety. And we tried to work the situation out with the university themselves, but they just weren't really willing to work with us. So that's when we had to get Ann involved.
Ann Bremner, your attorney. But what specifically were you asking?
Ann Bremner.
What were you asking Melinda Husky for, the school in general for?
I was asking for assistance to my classroom. I was also asking for a different change of scenery for my dorms. And, you know, a lot of times, well, I was just too afraid to even leave my dorm at the time. So she would still ask me to come and speak with her in her meetings, or speak with her
office.
In her office, even though I was too afraid to even leave my dorm. They also didn't really provide me with assistance with my classes. I had to drop a lot of my coursework. And, you know, at that time, I was a 3.0 student. So mm-hmm. It was really upsetting for me to fall behind in my studies as well.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Dominique Stewart. She was 18 years old at the time where she was the alleged victim of racist taunts and harassment both on campus and online, simply based upon the color of her skin, and in a lawsuit against Wazoo represented by Ann Bremner, Dominique makes the point that they were negligent in protecting her from this hostile campus environment. You allege, Dominique, that you are now living with PTSD and anxiety as a result of what happened on campus. When did you seek treatment where you were, you know, given that label of PTSD?
I was seeking treatment right from the beginning.
Okay.
When they labeled me with the PTSD.
And you told the school that you were seeking this kind of treatment? Because the one thing I will say is, you know, if you're an administrator and a student says, come meet at my dorm room rather than the office, they probably would look at that and say, that's a little unorthodox. That's not how it's supposed to happen. They might not have known that they needed to accommodate you in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I had told them that I didn't feel safe to leave my dorm at the time. So, and my mother told them as well.
In retrospect, when you look back at what happened, do you think that that was a reasonable fear that you had?
Yeah, I do think that it was a reasonable fear. The environment was just very hostile, and I felt like I didn't have the support of, you know, my family was 4 or 5 hours away. So it was really just me by myself on that campus. And it was just, you know, overwhelming for an 18-year-old who was just going there to seek, you know, to seek education, have all that extra stuff happening, wasn't expecting that.
Did you ever call the police?
And wake up. Yeah. Yes. So the police was called after that incident when I had the chicken thrown at my head.
What did they do?
So, you know, that phone call was just something I wasn't expecting at all. They had told me to walk back to Greek Row and try to find the license plate of the person who had thrown the chicken at my head. And I told them, like, I don't feel comfortable walking back there at this time. I was just completely, you know, afraid for my safety.
Mm-hmm. And so did it sort of just end at that point? Did they ever find out who did it?
No, they never found out who did it. And I also reported it to the university, and they didn't seek they need to do more investigation at that time.
Do you still go to Wazoo?
I actually graduated from WSU May 5th, 2018.
Okay, so just about a week ago. Why did you stay at Wazoo despite not feeling comfortable going to class on your own and just the general environment of how you were being treated?
I had severe physical and emotional distress, but I just worked so hard to get to university, and my family, especially my mom, worked hard to provide me with an opportunity to have education.
Yeah. And at what point, and this will be my last question, at what point did you feel comfortable, you know, leaving the dorm room and going back to a somewhat normal life on campus?
I'm going to say that I never really felt comfortable to walk on campus.
But you still left the dorm room, obviously. You were given an escort to all of your classes. They didn't give in on that. So about how long did it take for you to resume relatively normal habits, even if you did feel uncomfortable?
I never had really felt comfortable again. You know, there was never that safety to just leave my house and get to class. I always felt like I needed to carry mace or watch my back or try to walk with a roommate. But I never had that safety again.
Again, I've been talking with Dominique Stewart at 18 years old back in 2015. She says she was the victim of racism on campus, racism that created a hostile campus environment that she believes Wazoo didn't do enough to protect her from. The lawsuit is pending now. Again, local attorney Ann Bremner, who's a friend of the show and a friend of mine, she represents Dominique in this lawsuit. Once we have more information, once we get more word from Wazoo, because we do want to be fair and present Wazoo's side of things, we'll certainly do that. Dominique, I appreciate you spending time talking about this lawsuit. I know you're not talking about it with many members of the media, so thank you for giving us your side of things.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. We have an update on a story we brought to you yesterday. We've gotten in contact with the guy who says he hit a deer on a ride in the Arlington-Darrington area. The deer flew into the air, landed in the backseat of his car, was still alive, and then started to kick the driver. I suspect it didn't happen. And he heard my segment that we did yesterday. And so now my plan to interrogate him probably won't go as I originally intended. So please return to Amazon that really light bulb and standalone.
And the handcuffs.
You just send it. Well, to be fair, you got fuzzy handcuffs for some reason. I don't know why you bought those.
They don't let you buy the police issued.
Well, you could have. Just like, it's not a fetish that we're trying to do here. It's just so weird. I don't know. The fuzzy pink handcuffs. I don't know why you would do that. And so
didn't want to scare him too bad.
Well, that might scare him more than the actual handcuffs. So return those. I'm going to have to reconfigure my plan because he knows that I'm suspicious going in.
Yeah. Well, because he apparently listened to the segment.
Yes. He feels bad that I accused him of becoming a doe serial killer.
Yeah, has he responded to the accusation that he strangled the deer?
Well, he didn't actually respond specifically to that. So, because he sent me a direct message on Twitter, and we'll have him on the show either tomorrow or Friday. He says, I have no car, an uninsured deer to recoup my losses, and the weight of being a doe murderer and leaving a fawn an orphan, which is all things we accused him of in horrific ways. Right. And we sometimes forget that people can listen to what it is we say.
So they can hear us.
Well, we never assume the person we're talking about ever listens.
Yeah.
Like, the chances of that happening are incredibly slim when we're talking about some random dude and a random story that we found. I don't even remember where we found Cairo, I think. So I'll have to figure out I don't know. But I've done a deep dive. I've done a background check already. We had you run his name through a few of our databases internally. We found a lot of stuff in his background that I'm going to be able to use to find out what truly happened. Because there's no way you hit a deer and it survives and lands in the back seat of your car. Didn't that happen in the movie Tommy Boy? Was that Tommy Boy that it happened? It was.
Oh, I don't remember.
Anyone?
I have another conspiracy theory to offer.
Well, hold on. 1-800-465-8770 if you know the reference to the movie I'm talking about. There was a deer that was hit by a car, and I think it was in the back seat, and then it was resurrected, mm-hmm. and it destroyed the car from the inside. I'm almost certain it's Tommy Boy.
I haven't seen Tommy Boy. My conspiracy theory is that this is not actually Greg Winters. It's just a super fan of the show who decided that they wanted to create... Well, they've at least taken the... They've created a Twitter account with this man's name, Greg Winters, mm-hmm. and perhaps how long ago when did he start tweeting?
2016.
All right, so
sorry, 2015.
2015. Okay, this would have to be a very long con.
Talk about a long con. He started this Twitter account years ago.
Yes.
With the anticipation that I would fall for a fake story 2 years later. Involving his name, and then would reach out to me via Twitter. So I don't think that's what happened.
Probably not, but that would be funny too. The texters are saying it is Tommy Boy. That's
right? Okay, thank you. So he's a super fan of Tommy Boy. Okay. I'm telling you, there's something suspicious going on here, and I will get the truth. You can't escape the truth.
How
from
can
me.
He prove it to you? It's already been reported on the news. So presumably, Cairo, who brought the story, did some fact checking. What more can
he do
to prove it?
That. On a story like this.
I mean, they've at least seen the car, and I think I saw a photo of the deer.
Okay, well, first of all, that's disgusting because it's dead now. Mm-hmm. It eventually died 20 minutes later. See, here's the deal. Most people will just say to themselves, oh, he wouldn't make up a crazy story like this. It's crazy enough that it must have happened. And they let their guard down, and so they just move on with it. I'm not going to prove that it didn't happen. That's what your problem is here. That's why you're not figuring this out. I'm not going to prove it didn't happen. I'm going to prove what happened, which was, I think he's a serial deer killer. That's what I think, and I'm going to prove that, which then inherently disproves the original story. That's my strategy.
They are describing in Tommy Boy something slightly more likely happened, which is that they hit the deer with their car, thought it was dead, but they couldn't leave it on the side of the road, so they put the deer in the back of the car, and it wakes up. As opposed to, which does seem highly less likely, it flying into the air and landing.
That didn't happen. This poor guy, though, his car was totaled. Yeah. And I guess insurance doesn't cover something like this, they don't cover that?
I don't know.
I mean, it's not driver
error. He's just happy to be alive.
The deer can't say the same.
Yeah, no, can't.
So we'll talk to him either tomorrow or Friday. You're listening to the Jason Rancho. Time to get you to work the right way with Right Way Traffic.